So today I will be doing some readings from a book published after the death of Lungtam Mahabua titled Samana. We have a number of copies available on the free distribution shelf. If anyone's interested, it has some nice photos and some very nice pieces put together. The translation is by Ajahn Jeff, and this whole book was compiled by Ajahn Dick Sila Ratano.
That was the translator, Ajahn Dick?
It says in the front cover that for the most part, the translations have been adapted from Ajahn Jeff translations.
Oh, okay.
But the whole thing was put together by Ajahn Dick. So. And for just very brief background info, for those who don't know who Lungtam Mahabua is, there have already been two readings from him, but for many years he was the most prominent and respected of Ajahn Mun's living disciples that were still alive. He just died recently in 2011 at the age of 97. And Lungta means venerable grandfather, is one translation. So I'll just read a few excerpts, skipping around a little bit from this first piece, which is autobiographical accounts from Lungtam Mahabua.
It's actually Lungtam kind of means it does sort of mean grandfather, but it also has a it's actually a self-deprecating title that he used. Because Lungta is sort of like somebody who ordains in their older age, in older life, as they're older, and tends to have a bit of a connotation of somebody who's not so sloppy, a bit sloppy maybe as a monk, easygoing. He used to sign his name as the old monk who loves his pillow. Sometimes, despite the fact that he has this incredibly fierce temperament and very uncompromising, it comes out in his softness comes out in other ways.
Do you know when he took on, when he started referring to himself as Lungtam?
Oh, when he was quite young.
Previously, Lungtam also sort of means like grandfather, but from your mother's side of the family.
But yeah, it's like a da in Thai is from grandfather from your mother's side. A bo is from your father's side.
Okay. My mother was a wonderfully patient and devoted woman. She told me that of all the 16 children she carried to birth, I was by far the most troublesome in the womb. I was either so still in her stomach that she thought I must have already died, or I was thrashing around so violently that she thought I must have been on the verge of death. The closer I came to birth, the worse those extremes became. Just before I was born, my mother and my father each had an auspicious dream. My father dreamed that he had received a very sharp knife, pointed at the tip with an elephant tusk handle and encased in a silver sheath. My father felt very pleased. My mother, on the other hand, dreamed that she had received a pair of gold earrings, which were so lovely that she couldn't resist the temptation to put them on and admire herself in the mirror. The more she looked, the more they impressed her. My grandfather interpreted these two dreams to mean that the course of my life would follow one of two extremes. If I chose the way of evil, I would be the most feared criminal of my time. My character would be so fearsome that I was bound to end up being a crime boss of unprecedented daring and ferocity, who would never allow himself to be captured alive and imprisoned, but would hide out in the jungle and fight the authorities to the death. At the other extreme, at the other extreme, if I chose the way of virtue, my goodness would be unequaled. I'd be bound to ordain as a Buddhist monk and become a field of merit for the world. So now I'm going to move to after his ordination. Soon after my ordination, I began reading the story of the Buddha's life, which immediately awakened a strong sense of faith in my heart. I was so moved by the Buddha's struggle to attain enlightenment that tears rolled down my cheeks as I read. Contemplating the scope of his attainment instilled in me a fervent desire to gain release from suffering. Toward that purpose, I decided to formally study the Buddha's teachings as a preparation for putting them into practice. With that aim in mind, I made a solemn vow to complete the third grade of Pali studies. As soon as I passed the third level Pali exams, I planned to follow the way of practice. I had no intention to study further or take exams for the higher levels. When I traveled to Chiang Mai to take my exams, by chance, Venerable Ajahn Mun arrived at Wat Chede Long in Chiang Mai at the time I did. As soon as I learned that he was staying there, I was overwhelmed with joy. When I returned from my alms round next morning, I learned from another monk that Ajahn Mun left for alms on a certain path and returned by the very same path. This made me even more eager to see him. Even if I couldn't meet him face to face, I'd be content to just have a glimpse of him before he left. The next morning, before Ajahn Mun went on his alms round, I hurried out early for alms and then returned to my quarters. From there, I kept watch on the path by which he would return, and before long, I saw him coming. With a longing that came from having wanted to see him for such a long time, I peeked out from my hiding place to catch a glimpse of him. The moment I saw him, a feeling of complete faith arose within me. I felt that because I had now seen an arahant, I hadn't wasted my birth as a human being. Although no one had told me that he was an arahant, my heart became firmly convinced of it the moment I saw him. At the same time, a feeling of sudden elation hard to describe came over me, making my hair stand on end. When I had passed my Pali exams, I returned to Bangkok with the intention of heading out to the countryside to practice meditation in line with my vow. But when I reached Bangkok, the senior monk who is my teacher insisted that I stay on. He was keenly interested to see me further my Pali studies. I tried to find some way to slip away because I felt that the conditions of my vow had been met the moment I had passed my Pali exams. Under no circumstances would I study for or take the next level of Pali exams. It's my temperament to value truthfulness. Once I've made a vow, I won't break it. Even life I don't value as much as a vow. So now I had to find some way to go out to practice. By a fortunate turn of events, that senior monk was suddenly invited out to the provinces, which gave me a chance to leave Bangkok while he was away. Had he been there, it would have been hard for me to get away because I was indebted to him in many ways and probably would have felt such deference for him that I would have had difficulty leaving. But as soon as I saw my chance, I had decided to make a vow that night, asking for an amen from the Dhamma to reinforce my determination to leave. So I'll skip ahead a little. Early the next morning, I went to take leave of the senior monk in charge of the monastery, who willingly gave me permission to go. From the very start of my practice, I was very earnest and committed, because that's the sort of person I am. I don't play around. When I take a stance, that's how it has to be. When I set out to practice, I had only one book, the Padimokkha, in my shoulder bag. Now I'd strive for the full path and the full results. I planned to give it my all, to give it my life. I wasn't going to hope for anything short of freedom from suffering. I felt sure that I would attain that release in this lifetime. All that I asked was that somehow someone show me the paths the fruitions, and nibbana were still attainable. I would give my life to that person and to the Dhamma without holding anything back. If it meant death, I'd die practicing meditation. I wouldn't die in ignoble retreat. My heart was set like a stone post. I spent the next rains in Chakrad district of Nakhon Ratchasima province because I hadn't been able to catch up with Ajahn Mun. As soon as I got there, I began accelerating my efforts, practicing both day and night. It wasn't long before my heart attained the stillness of samadhi. I wasn't willing to do any other work aside from the work of sitting and walking meditation, so I pushed myself until my samadhi was really solid. One day, just as my mind became calmed and concentrated, a vision appeared in my meditation. I watched as a white-robed renunciant walked up and stood about 6 feet in front of me. He was an impressive-looking man about 50 who was impeccably dressed and had an unusually fair complexion. As I gazed at him, he looked down at his hands and started to count on his fingers. He counted one finger at a time until he reached 9, then glanced up at me and said, "In 9 years you'll attain." Later, I contemplated the meaning of this vision. The only attainment that I truly desired was freedom from suffering. By that time, I had been ordained for 7 years, and it hardly seemed likely that 2 more years gave me enough time to succeed. Surely it couldn't be that easy. I decided to begin counting from the year I left to begin practicing. By that reckoning, I should attain my goal in 9 years' time, in my 16th rains retreat. If the vision was indeed prophetic, then that time frame seemed quite reasonable. When I finally reached Venerable Ajahn Mun, he taught me the Dhamma as if it came straight from his heart. He would never use the words, "It might be like that," or "It seems to be like this," because his knowledge came directly from personal experience. It was as though he kept saying, "Right here, right here." Where were the paths, the fruitions in nibbana? Right here, right here. My heart was convinced, really convinced. So I made a solemn vow. As long as he was still alive, I would not leave him as my teacher. No matter where I went, I'd have to return for him. With that determination, I accelerated my efforts in meditation. Several nights later, I had another amazing vision. I dreamed that I was fully robed, carrying my bowl and umbrella tent, and following an overgrown trail through the jungle. Both sides of the trail were massive thorns and brambles. My only option was to continue following the trail, which was just barely a path, just enough to give a hint of where to go. Shortly, I reached a point where a thick clump of bamboo had fallen across the trail. I couldn't see which way to continue. There was no way around it on either side. How was I going to get past it? I peered here and there until finally I saw an opening, a tiny opening right along the path. Just enough for me to squeeze my way through together with my bowl. Since there was no other option, I removed my outer robe and folded it up neatly. I removed the bowl strap from my shoulder and crawled through the opening, dragging my bowl by its strap and pulling my umbrella tent behind me. I was able to force my way through, dragging my bowl, my umbrella tent, and my robe behind me, but it was extremely difficult. I kept at it for a long time until I finally worked my way free. Then I pulled my bowl until my bowl came through. I pulled my umbrella tent and my robe, and they came through. As soon as everything was safely through, I put on my robe again, slung my bowl over my shoulder, and told myself, "Now I can continue." I followed that overgrown trail for another 100 feet. Then looking up, I suddenly saw nothing but wide open space. In front of me appeared a great ocean. Looking across it, I saw no further shore. All I could see was the shore where I stood and a tiny island sitting way out in the distance. like a black speck on the edge of the horizon. I was determined to head for that island. As soon as I walked down to the water's edge, a boat came up to the shore and I got in. The boatman didn't speak to me at all. As soon as I got my bowl and other things in the boat and sat down, the boat sped out to the island without my having to say a word. I don't know how it happened. It just sped out to the island. There didn't seem to be any disturbances or waves whatsoever. Gliding silently, we arrived in a flash because, after all, it was a dream. As soon as we reached the island, I got my things out of the boat and went ashore. The boat disappeared immediately, without my saying even a word to the boatman. I slung my bowl over my shoulder and climbed up the island. I kept climbing until I saw Ajahn Mun sitting on a small bench, pounding betel nut, as he watched me climb towards him. "Maha," he said, "how did you get here? Since when has anyone come that way? How are you able to make it here?" "I came by boat." "Oh, that trail is really difficult. Nobody dares to risk his life coming that way." "Very well then. Now that you're here, pound my betel for me." He handed me his betel pounder, and I pounded away. Chuck, chuck, chuck. After the second or third chuck, I woke up. I felt somewhat disappointed. I wished I could have continued with the dream to at least see how it ended. The next morning, I went to tell my vision to Ajahn Mun. He interpreted it very well. "This dream," he said, "is very auspicious. It shows a definite pattern for your practice. Follow the practice in the way that you dreamed. In the beginning, it will be extremely difficult. You have to give it your best effort. Don't retreat. The beginning part where you made it through the clump of bamboo, that's the difficult part. The mind will make progress only to slip back over and over again. So give it your best. Don't ever retreat. Once you get past that, it's all wide open. You'll get to the island of safety without any trouble. That's not the hard part. The hard part is here at the beginning." So I'll leave it there.
In that book, I remember several times Onga talks about looking for a sign for these visions. Mm-hmm. Does he ever comment anywhere else about, you know, what he means by that? Is he actually thinking some other, like, deva or brahmins are going to guide him, or was he looking for something within himself?
It's like an inner vision. That's quite common. For Thai monks, well, lay people, tradition, Thai culture, to look for an omen. I think it's, you know, it's also something that was reasonably common in Western culture until sort of the age of science and rationalism and material, you know, sort of materialism. It was also paying attention to dreams, where one is tuned into one's dreams and seeing that they're giving one some kind of guidance. Sometimes when you're, say, for practitioners, to ask for an omen or something, and then you would, it's very common to, you know, if you're at a place of kind of difficulty in practice, or then, going and doing a puja and setting a resolution in the mind, kind of with that wish or in request for an omen, a vision of some sort, then that one would pay attention to what comes up. So that's a very common it's very common, and it's sort of that tuning into the inner world. That's like when years and years ago, Ajahn Tiradhammo started to collect some of the. He just started doing a translation of Ajahn Chah's. There was a short biography that was done a long time ago, and it was a bit jumbled and unclear. Some of the occurrences, and so Ajahn Tiradhammo started to try to get some of the chronology sorted out and some of the stories a bit clearer. But anyway, he went and asked Ajahn Chah with a group of others, and you know, they were there. Asking, you know, what was it that made you feel, you know, that you were really kind of on the path to realizing your goal and your thinking? Because there's these different circumstances in Ajahn Chah's life that where his, you know, his body exploded in a vision several times, or when he went to meet with this particular monk who was a close student of Ajahn Mahi. So they're different. And Ajahn Chah started to develop and it was in his biography as well, about these dreams he had at Sur Glue. And that's interior was sort of no. I mean, what really? What? You know, what was the real thing? And so I was like, and Ajahn thought, oh, this was real. This is that. So that dreams, visions, omens. This is very much a part of the way that ties and many cultures. Or relate to the inner and outer world.
When I was on my tunong down in Mississippi, I met this yoga teacher down in Yazoo City, Mississippi, and she was having a really hard time. She's got a physical prejudice against sort of Hindu practices and stuff like that. And I said, Michelle, how did you end up in Mississippi? She was in English. And how did you end up in Mississippi? And she said, well, her and her husband he was from that area, I guess, and got a job offer down there. And she's like, I was looking for a home. She's like, I actually asked for a home. And she said that night they were watching the Blues Brothers. And the scene that probably nobody had ever noticed, but they get in the Bluesmobile and they're heading down the highway. And there's a sign that says Yazoo City. And I was like, Michelle, don't you think that meant Yazoo City, Illinois? She's like, I'm going to kill you. So omens can be good, but you have to be able to read them.
You have to know how to read them.
did any of the Western monks go to Lumbar Chad and to ask about their own dreams? And did you ever remember that came or answer?
Yeah.
So you would kind of direct people and say, oh, this is what that means? And
sometimes, yeah. Hmm. Yeah, and that would be... Yeah, which is, you know, that's quite common. I mean, like, for myself in Thailand, as a teacher, then people would come and have this particular dream, either curious about it or just sort of stating the fact. This is what it was.
Awesome. The stories and autobiography release, was this something he wrote, or is this something he spoke to his students, you know?
Probably both. He's one of the few forest teachers who was quite prolific at writing. I remember the which again, it's sort of, you have this image of Ajahn Mahabodhi being, you know, this fierce taskmaster, but his, I remember, it was actually the person who was telling me this was the secretary to Ajahn Phan, another of the great Ajahn Mun disciples, and he said, well, you'd be at Wat Pa Da, Ajahn Mahabodhi's monastery, and be quite quiet during the day, and then you'd hear this tap, 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 tap. He's on a typewriter. And this is how he would write his either the different, I mean, he did Ajahn Mun biography, a biography of Bukhal, Meiji Gero, and he typed all sorts of other books that he did. He also used to, there's a very interesting book of Ajahn Mahabodhi's, which is a compilation of letters and answers, like letters that were written and then his answers to them. So that he used to do correspondence with people all over the country about their practice. So it's an interesting juxtaposition. It's just an incredibly compassionate effort going into to teach and to write and to record things, and then also his. It's a very strong commitment to practice and training, both training himself and training the monks in his monastery.
Do you have any information as to what the level 3 poly sort of testing or anything, what that actually includes?
I don't. I just know it's that's the first. There's 3 levels of general study that are done, so that say like Ajahn Chah finished his 3rd level of the general studies, and that come 3 to an egg, and those are the Dhamma studies. And the higher level of the of those Dhamma studies is quite extensive, and then it goes into your Pali studies, which is then you're beginning to both really learn the structures and the Pali language, and but a lot of it is commentarial literature that one is studying as well, so that and then that's you know, it's quite difficult to pass the exams, and then but your 3rd degree Pali is your first level of Pali studies, once you finish the 3 levels of Dhamma studies. So that, and then goes to like ninth degree Pali studies, which is very difficult to 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, and then to get a 9th degree is just extremely difficult. Usually takes, you know, for somebody who is very clever, intelligent, able to memorize, able to work diligently, usually takes about 20 years. And that's why in Thailand, that from time to time, you'll have some of these young, bright novices who are able to study, like Prabhupada. So that he finished his ninth degree Pali when he was a novice. And then when that happens, then the king is the sponsor for his ordination. And then they take ordination in the temple of the Emerald Buddha, which is not a monastery, it's like a national shrine. So that you have these, from time to time you have that happening. So that there's a few of those monks around. Because it normally takes easy 20 years for somebody who's very, very, very sharp.
Yeah. What do they do with that?
What do they do with it?
Yeah.
They'll end up being, they're scholars, they're teachers, they're administrators sometimes, depends. Like Prabhupada is he's like a national resource of knowledge. And when somebody wants some advice on a particular, not only is just that, you have to learn how to think as well. You've got this incredible body of knowledge of the scriptures and commentaries and the tradition that you're a repository for all that knowledge. And somebody like that there's a monk who I know who was he's a bit younger than Prabhupada. I met him in June when I was in when I went to DC, and he's the head of the Buddhist University. Mm-hmm. In Bangkok. There's two Buddhist universities, one for the Mahanikaya, one for the Dhammayu, and he's the head of the Mahanikaya Buddhist University, and it's it'll be the most as a Pali scholar or a Buddhist scholar, that's the foremost place to be. He's also he does some within the Buddhist administration of the Sangha. But he's also, I met him at Wat Nanachaya, because every year, he would, even though he had this Knights of Ripali, career as a scholar, every year he would leave and go and do a retreat in the forest. So I met him. He came and spent time at Wat Nanachaya when I was the abbot there. And as a younger monk, then he put attention on the practice. So that's actually quite rare. It's very, very good, and he's an incredibly articulate speaker, engaging speaker. So he's a real bright light in the Sangha. Say, another monk who's got his ninth degree Pali, I really want to get him here. He spent a bit of time at Amaravati. And Ajahn, because his village where he grew up is just behind, he's from Tungwa. You were there.
He spent a year at Amaravati.
And then he spent time at Wat Nanachaya. You guys were there?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. See, he's a really good monk. I'd love to get him here. But he's a local. I mean, he came out with his mother and putting food in the bowls of the, like when Ajahn Sumedho first started going alms round in his village. And that was, seeing a great cute, he's just this little kid, this big white guy. But he's a he's somebody who is, as Nikes of Ripali, staying out of the kind of the administrative realms, scholarly realms. He's spending more time in forest monasteries, different people do different things with them. I mean, if he decided that he wanted to go into the administrative realms, and they snap him up like nothing, but he's avoiding that and putting more focus on the actual practice. And he translated Ajahn Amaro's book on, it was just finished translated when I was there. The one on the Four Noble Truths that he gave at Yomo. It was a series of talks of over four weeks or something. He said it was the most difficult thing he's ever done. Because it's Ajahn Amaro was one, just this, it's a lot, it's quite colloquial in his language, and then also the people that were there weren't really Buddhists, so that there's a lot of colloquial language and concepts that are not strictly kind of Buddhist. He said he regretted even taking the project on. It was a lot of hard work.